You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Perhaps the most notorious paranormal event that is alleged to occur is that of a poltergeist infestation. Usually, a family will endure the visitation of a violent, malicious, and frustrating polt. Whilst quite rare, some cases have become well known, from the Enfield case, the Black Monk of Pontefract, and the Amherst mystery, amongst others. Yet one case, which hit the national TV and newspaper headlines back in 1956, seemed to have been forgotten. Now, thanks to writer and producer Danny Robbins, it seems everyone is talking about the Battersea Poltergeist. Thanks to his fantastic new BBC podcast, the story of Shirley Hitchings and her family's ordeal at 63 Wycliffe Road has finally reached a wider audience that this case truly deserves. A mix of investigation, discussion, and dramatic recreation, the Battersea Poltergeist has been one of the best podcasts I've listened to in a long time. Danny and I discuss the show's germination, his other fantastic paranormal show, Haunted, as well as the case, how he got to meet Shirley and her poltergeist pest, the rambunctious Donald, and the forgotten parapsychologist, Harold Chibbert. A big thank you to Danny for joining me, and to Hayley Stevens, who appeared back on episode 78, for introducing us properly. Before we get there, don't forget you can sign up to support the show on Patreon for $4 a month, and the link's in the show notes as usual. Our website is also live at mysteriesandmonsters.com, and you can find us across all social media platforms. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. As always, artwork for the show is by Dean Bestall. The show is produced by Brennan Storr from the Ghost Story Guys. And Mysteries and Monsters is proud to be part of the Straight Up Strange Network. Along with appearing on the cover of this month's 14 Times, let's travel back to the winter of 1956 in the company of Danny Robbins to meet Donald, the Battersea Poltergeist. On today's show, I'm delighted to welcome Danny Robbins, the writer and presenter of BBC Radio 4's smash hit podcast, The Battersea Poltergeist. Focusing on one of Britain's forgotten poltergeist cases, Danny's show has introduced a whole new audience to the terror inflicted on Shirley Hitchings and her family by Donald, the fearsome poltergeist from 56 to 68. Danny, delighted to welcome you to Mysteries and Monsters, sir. How are we?
I'm very good, Paul. Thank you.
Oh, well, it's as I said on the introduction, I'm delighted to welcome you. I know we've spoken briefly in the past about your previous paranormal show, which was a wonderful podcast series about 4 years ago called Haunted.
Gosh, was it that long? That's scary hearing it that long ago. But yeah, I mean, that was the show that kind of started me on this journey towards this case, the Battersea Poltergeist, I guess. You know, it was making that I was actually introduced to the Battersea Poltergeist. One of the people who took part in that told me about the story of Shirley Hitchings and said, I've got this story that you might be interested in, this box of files on this case, and the woman it happened to is still alive, and would you like to talk to her? So yeah, absolutely. The kind of the genius of this was in Haunted, that, you know, Haunted was a series about telling individual ghost stories, one per episode, and then here suddenly was the Battersea Poltergeist, which clearly wasn't just one episode. It was a much, much bigger story, a story that spread over 12 years and was filled with so many amazing phenomena, so much phenomena and so many amazing incidents. So yes, I mean, that really was the start of this journey.
Yeah, I mean, I loved Haunted because I liked the way each episode was kind of broken down, Danny, because I kind of stumbled across it. A friend of mine knew that I was really into podcasts, especially paranormal ones. It's one of my key sources of entertainment these days. And he said, "Oh, have you heard this show?" And I listened to the first couple, which I remember about the family who had the poltergeist in their house with the newborn baby.
Yeah.
And then the rather terrifying Brooklyn's Racecourse episode with with Percy turning up. But yeah. I have to say, probably my favourite episode is the wonderful gentleman Jim, who's got that ghost that lives in his bedroom.
Yeah, that was just beautiful, absolutely beautiful. Yeah, I mean the incredible thing about that series was that I think the most powerful thing about it was that in most instances these were people who didn't believe in ghosts who had seen a ghost, and it was very powerful because I think we're very used to watching paranormal shows on TV where we have, you know, people running around haunted houses screaming and we have mediums channeling ghosts and you know we're kind of used to all that kind of thing of, you know, going to a haunted house and having those experiences. But these were people who, you know, who resolutely kind of didn't believe in ghosts, but just had this thing where seemingly a ghost had chosen to enter their existence. And, you know, there was some sort of experience they'd had in their previously very normal house that had, you know, scared them or confused them or, you know, in some cases comforted them, I guess, you know. But that's what intrigued me, I think. And yeah, I mean, it was just, you know, they were great storytellers, I think. I was very privileged to be told those stories. And I felt like with each one, you had somebody who had a very powerful story to tell that really resonated because of the, you know, the normalness of them. You know, they felt like this is something that could easily happen to us.
Hmm.
And, yeah, I mean, you know, it's the power of a good ghost story. And really, you see that in Battersea Poltergeist as well, that, you know, that's on a grander scale. It's across 12 years and a heck of a lot more happens. But, you know, there is something that fascinates us as a society about ghosts. They're kind of a crucial mechanism in our society, I think. They are a way for us to process death. They are a way for us to try and explain and make sense of this idea that we will cease to exist and you know that our lives that we spent so long working to turn into something and, you know, building all these relationships and these, you know, these moments in our lives, and suddenly they're snuffed out. And ghosts clearly are a necessary part of our sort of way of processing, you know, that shift from light to darkness, if you like. So you know, that's what's always fascinated me, I guess, and that's I've not had a ghost experience. I'm somebody who I guess is, you know, largely skeptic, but wants to believe and, you know, and would love to have an experience. And so I find myself living vicariously through these people who have had these experiences.
Well, to be fair, going on Donald's behaviour, that's probably the best way to have a ghost experience, Danny.
Yeah, absolutely. I would not want to go through what Shirley Hitchings went through in the Battersea Poltergeist. I mean, that you know, that poor family, their whole family had their lives changed forever by what happened in the house. And, you know, people will have very different viewpoints on you know, the causes for what happened. And some people will believe that it was the spirit of a dead person. And some people will believe that it was, you know, the product of human minds and a psychological drama, but whatever happened undoubtedly had this huge, huge impact on that family.
Obviously, your normal work is more often in writing for sitcoms and comedy. Danny, you've got a long resume of excellent work, I have to say, as a fan of Rudy's Rare Records as well as other shows. And it's one of those things that I was very struck by looking at this kind of switch that you've got this aspect of your career, because it's very rare that someone can sort of take a subject such as this, the paranormal, and treat it as balanced as you have over both Haunted and the Battersea Poltergeist. And as you say, it's something you've got a real interest in, despite not having any kind of paranormal experience yourself. So I know you touched on it there, that when you were working on Haunted, Battersea kind of dropped in your lap and someone sort of said, well, I've got this case that you really need to look at. So what was the germination, Danny? Because this is obviously a massive undertaking from the breakdown of the whole episode format. I mean, the cast you've managed to pull together here is incredible, which is one of the other things that's really struck me about the way the Battersea Poltergeist series has been designed in kind of a half drama, half detective story, really, as the listeners are joining in and wanting to get to the bottom of it. So was that a deliberate decision to kind of mix it up a little bit, or did you just kind of think, let's try something a bit different with this one?
No, I mean, I was very keen to use that medium of mixing drama and documentary. And it was something I'd tried a little bit on a series that I made for Audible probably about 2 years ago now. I told the story of Johnny Cash's Folsom Prison concert. I think it tied in with the anniversary, the 50th anniversary. And I told the story of that concert across five parts. And we used small elements of drama in it to bring moments to life. And it struck me as a kind of great way to fits in with our conversation, but to bring the dead to life, you know, that,
yes.
that those moments where you don't have those interviewees anymore, the people who've passed away, to kind of, you know, still bring them to life and make it feel very fresh, you know. And I really wanted to do that in Battersea Poltergeist because you had a cast of amazing characters, you know, Shirley's family, you know, anyone who's heard the series will know this, and people who haven't, you know, will hopefully find out, but, you know, the grandmother is an incredible character, the mother and father, you've got her adopted brother, the ghost hunter Harold Chibbert, who comes into her life. Each of these people is an absolute, you know, godsend as a writer. They are really strong and powerful characters who kind of leap off the page, and so it just felt very natural to bring them to life, and I guess we were a little bit nervous about how that mix would work because, you know, I think the audience for audio drama and the audience for audio documentaries are quite different and don't necessarily cross over. And I think, you know, drama documentary is a kind of a medium that we're familiar with, you know, on television we see those moments, but it's often, you know, the drama is often there just to add a little bit of background colour to a documentary scene. You know, you're watching, you know, a documentary about Guy Fawkes and you sort of see a little scene of the plotters meeting or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
But you know, I was very keen to do something that was literally 50-50 and, you know, had these kind of split narratives of bringing the 1956 haunting and Harold Chibbert's investigation to life whilst I did my own. And I think, you know, the moment that we cracked it was the moment that we sort of realized that the drama was like a tool at our disposal. You know, like we were conducting this investigation and, you know, there were different ways we could explore it. We could do kind of controlled experiments or you know, or we could do interviews, you know, and we could go to drama scenes. And, you know, it was the drama was a way of exploring this case and trying to dive into it. So then it started to feel very organic, I think, and it sort of felt like it was very integrated and a part of it, and it wasn't like these were two separate things that happened to, you know, be running alongside each other, you know. And I mean, actually, crucially, the thing that makes the drama feel very real is Shirley herself, that you've got this incredible witness who was there, this powerful testimony from a woman who's now 80 but was 15 when this happened. And whenever we dropped a line from the interviews with Shirley into one of the drama scenes, it just instantly makes it feel real. You totally, it grounds it, and you totally believe in this because here's Shirley telling you that this is how it was, you know. And I mean, I tried to be as accurate as I could with the drama scenes. I was, you know, they were very much based on my interviews with Shirley and the notes from Harold Chibbert, the investigator, and the newspaper articles. So, you know, I've obviously had to take, you know, a degree of dramatic license because we don't have word for word transcripts of what was said. But I think, you know, just the interviews with Shirley were such that I felt like, you know, I got a real strong sense of the characters and the family. And, you know, now having written those scenes, when Shirley hears them, she says that they feel truthful. You know, they feel, you know, authentic. It does sound like her family, you know. So but for me, that was really good to hear that.
Yeah. And it's remarkable, as we say, this case, because one of the other aspects about this whole story is Harold Chibbert, who seems to be, to me, Danny, one of these forgotten heroes of British paranormal history, because I suspect this is because Harold passed away in the 70s before we kind of got this modern explosion of interest in the paranormal, because he kind of predates television picking it up and taking a real interest as it started to do in the 1980s. And ironically, he passed away kind of halfway through the infamous Enfield case. Which,
I know. And he lived very close to Enfield, interestingly, actually, not far away at all.
So I think Harold's one of those people who, unfortunately, was probably born about 10 years too soon. Because I think if he'd have lived on a little bit further, he would probably be more recognised, I think, to anybody who's got an interest in the paranormal, primarily as well, because he's also not got a lot of writing that we can kind of look back on, other than what Shirley was able to salvage from when his house was being cleared, which is a real shame as well, because I know Harold's one of these characters that when you delve into his life, you know, he met and got to know people like Harry Price, and he met Aleister Crowley and a whole range of British Fortean characters in the 40s and 50s and 60s. And yet, here we are in 2021, and I think unless you've got a real interest in the paranormal, Danny, most people don't know who Harold Chibbutt was.
I think that's very true, and I think, you know, Googling him is not easy. There's very little information out there. Like you said, the people that he knew, I mean, he was, you know, on friendly terms with Arthur Conan Doyle as well. And, you know, and he wrote his own ghost stories and science fiction stories. He really was a bit of a polymath. I think he spoke about four languages, and he was one of the earliest Fortians. You know, he had a really broad interest in esoterica, and, you know, was fascinated by UFOs. Yes, I mean, I think he was a product of that golden age of ghost hunting. You know, he was a contemporary, and you could maybe even sort of argue a rival of Harry Price. But obviously, Harry Price leaves this legacy of having written successful books, and Chibb leaves a legacy of this kind of unpublished book about the Battersea case, which he touted around but never got published. And, you know, you could argue that he sort of was a victim of his own obsession with the Battersea case, and really that he you know, it dominated the latter half of his life, and you know, it totally took him over, and he ended up going down a bit of a rabbit hole, you could argue, really, with it. But yeah, I mean, he's such a fascinating character, and he is, you know, I think in the 50s when he investigates this case, he feels a little bit like a man out of time, that, you know, he is a product of the 20s and 30s, of, you know, that golden age, you know, when sort of there was this huge, huge boom of interest in contacting the dead. And, you know, and he's somebody who served in the First World War. And, you know, you can see very clearly why he has this deep and profound interest in contacting the dead. He's lived through two wars, two incredibly traumatic experiences, and seen many of his friends die. And, you know, and then here he is with this kind of very, you know, I mean, Shirley feels like a really modern presence at the heart of this. Every time I look at photos of Shirley, she looks like she's a 21st century teenager who's time traveled back to the 50s. She's very cool and very modern. And, you know, here he is kind of at the dawn of rock and roll. You know, Elvis releases Heartbreak Hotel the month the haunting starts. You know, James Dean's just died. You know, it's the kind of the birth of the modern teenager as a concept. And here's kind of old Edwardian Chibb kind of striding in, and, you know, this kind of great, but, you know, kind of really kind of lovely partnership between him and Shirley, you know, that he is this, you know, in other hands, you know, with a different character, that could have felt a bit sinister, this kind of old man coming in and telling this teenager she's haunted. But there's something that's just so lovable and sympathetic about Chibb. And I think, you know, he really did play an enormous role in Shirley's life and in the family's life. And I think, you know, kept them sane, really, to some extent.
Yeah. So when you were kind of earmarked in regards to this case, Danny, did you kind of look at it and think, I can't believe anybody's not done a deep dive into this? Or was it, did you think, well, we'll have a look at it and see how we think, and then all of a sudden you realised, essentially, you'd got a paranormal gold mine?
Yeah, I mean, it's a funny one. I mean, I think it has sort of slipped under the radar, and I think it's because of when it happened, I think. I mean, like, you know, Enfield in the 70s, you know, the TV crew turned up fairly early on and recorded so much material. And then, you know, then that ends up on YouTube. You've got all this video footage. That I was talking to Ros Morris, one of the journalists that Enfield, and she said, you know, Enfield wasn't the big thing that everybody talks about now until YouTube came along, and suddenly people were watching videos about it all the time. You know, it's sort of, it's you know, the internet has grown and fed the legend of Enfield. You know, and we just don't have that material with Battersea. You know, there is no video footage. You know, there is no audio footage. There's nothing that you can share, really. You know, there's the newspaper headlines and, you know, all the amazing files of Chibb and the letters involved and all that sort of thing. But it's not the sort of immediate kind of hit that you want, you know, that when people are sort of, you know, wandering through YouTube wanting to find kind of spooky paranormal stories. So I think that's kind of the reason why it's not kind of been a part of the public consciousness, I think. And yeah, I mean, you know, clearly, you know, I think we've seen now in terms of, you know, the interest around the series. I mean, you know, it's had like 2-page spreads in every tabloid newspaper. And, you know, it's, Shirley's been on ITV's This Morning and on Breakfast Telly in Australia. I mean, there's clearly, you know, people love a ghost story. People particularly love a poltergeist story because it's that most tangible of hauntings. And, you know, and people love to find a poltergeist story that hasn't been done to death in the way that most of them have. So, yes, I mean, it's very exciting, but I don't think that, you know, there wasn't, when I first talked to Shirley, there wasn't a sense of me kind of going like, oh my God, you know, why don't more people know about this? I just approached and I sort of saw an incredibly interesting, incredibly personal story that I felt was very rich, and then I read the book that Shirley wrote with James Clark. That's a really, you know, interesting read and really does the case justice in terms of just, you know, the kind of showing the sheer breadth of phenomena that happened. And, you know, I felt it was a very, very rich story, but I guess in a way it's been the process of making the series that has made me realize kind of how kind of, you know, culturally and socially important the story is in terms of kind of a history of the paranormal, if you like. And I think it, you know, one of the things that fascinates me most is it comes in almost like this perfect period for it. It's such a product of its time. It's you've got this society trying to process the death of the Second World War and this fascination with the paranormal post Second World War, and then this birth of the modern teenager and this incredible scrutiny on Shirley, the teenager at the heart of this, and the very salacious media coverage around it, that this you know, the portrayal of Shirley as having like a ghost lover and the poltergeist is her boyfriend, you know. And I think, you know, it's a really interesting product of its time, you know. And you know, I remember Roger Clark, who wrote the brilliant book A Natural History of Ghosts, saying once to me that you know, we kind of each ghost, you know, each era has the ghosts that are the product of their time. You know, you kind of, you know, you get the ghosts that your society deserves or needs or creates. And, you know, like the ghosts of the 18th century were obsessed with wills and codicils and, you know, sort of revealing where, you know, family, you know, heirlooms were, that sort of thing. And, you know, and then clearly, you know, post First World War, you get this real need to kind of contact, you know, this very raw grief, this need to contact the dead. And, you know, and here we have, you know, 1950s, the era of rock and roll and James Dean. And, you know, you have this kind of, you know, doomed love affair between a ghost and a teenager, you know, well, that's the way it was portrayed, you know. So, you know, that fascinated me. I kind of love exploring the kind of the context of the haunting, you know, the kind of socio kind of cultural kind of historic context of the haunting, and how, you know, whatever you believe about ghosts and the source of them, how they are a product of us and the times they come from.
Yeah. So I was very interested because it strikes me, because Shirley and James did the book in 2013, and it seems as though it's only sort of the last 10 years, Danny, that Shirley seems to have come to terms with this and been more comfortable, because as you touched on there in regards to the explosion of cases such as Enfield and things, it would have been easier perhaps to have come forward 10 years before, you know. So, as you touched on there, the Enfield case probably got a real boost from Channel 4 doing that documentary about 2004, 2005, I think it was, which featured some key interviews with everybody involved in the case. Did you kind of get to the bottom why Shirley had kind of come to terms with it now, or is it simply she's got to an age where she just doesn't care what anybody thinks about what happened?
I think coming to terms with it is exactly the right term, really. I mean, I think, you know, for a long time she didn't feel ready to talk about it. And, you know, I mean, so many of these moments in this case feel like they sort of play out like scenes from a film. But one scene that really struck me, and, you know, we sort of fought long and hard about starting the whole series for this moment, but Shirley basically got contacted by Harold Chibbett's family after Chibbett's wife had died, saying that they were going to get rid of all his material, and they'd found some stuff about Shirley, and I think Chibbett had left a note saying that Shirley should have access to this material, like if she wanted it, she should come and get it. And Shirley and her husband Derek jumped in the car, drove up to London, and just saved this material before it was thrown in on the tip, and salvaged essentially this record of Shirley's childhood, her life, you know, and just this incredible record. But also, you know, it was kind of like a Pandora's box. You know, it was like, you know, in opening that box, she would bring this trauma back. You know, she would, you know, give life to Donald again. And so she didn't want to do that. So she took the box back to her house, put it in her attic, and it sat there for 25 years, you know. And she told me the other day about how her son, age 16, had found this box in the attic and started looking through it and reading it and reading about his mum's ghost story. And she had to sit him and her daughter down. And her daughter at that point was age 15, the same age that Shirley had been when it happened to her. And she had to talk to them about it. And she was really worried about this idea of bringing it back. And you can kind of understand that, you know, whether you kind of literally believe that you would bring Donald back, or you just believe that implanting that idea into the heads of children, it could disturb them. But yeah, really powerful. So I think it wasn't until James Clark, the writer she wrote the book with, approached her to chat about doing something about her case. He'd heard about it through somebody. And then I think, you know, that was the first time she really looked at the files and felt able to kind of think about it again, you know. And I think, you know, and particularly now, you know, sort of having been through, you know, the kind of publicity of making the series, I think she feels that it's been therapeutic, really, for her. And you know, she had that strange fame as a 15-year-old in an era when it wasn't normal for ordinary people to become famous. You know, we're very used to that now, but it was quite abnormal for the girl at number 63 Wycliffe Road to suddenly be, you know, on the cover of the newspapers and on primetime telly talking about her ghost. You know, she had that, and, you know, she was, you know, kind of really mishandled by the press and became a bit of a victim, really, in terms of the way they treated her. It was very salacious and quite prurient and quite unpleasant, really. And now she's had this second brush of fame through the series on her terms, you know, which I think is brilliant. You know, she's, you know, you can see how the audience connect with her, and you can see, you know, just seeing how the journalists connect with her. And the reason that they've been writing a lot about this case is, you know, because she's a compelling storyteller and a compelling kind of witness. And, you know, it's lovely for me to see the reactions to Shirley from the audience through the emails we get and social media. And, you know, people have this warmth towards her that, you know, you're rooting for her. You go on this journey with her. And fundamentally, it boils down to the very thing that made me feel like there was something in this when I was talking to her is just that little quality in her voice. There's something about the way she tells this story that makes you believe her, you know, and you feel like she's telling the truth. And so as soon as you feel that, it opens these kind of spectacular possibilities, because you feel like, you know, if you're a believer, then this is the closest that I have ever come to proving that ghosts exist. And if you're a skeptic, then you're thinking, you know, okay, I'm a skeptic, but this person believes what they're talking about. They believe they have witnessed these things. So how the hell did that happen? What the hell happened here to make this person, and indeed the whole family, believe that they were being haunted for 12 years to the point where it destroyed their lives? You know, what went on there? What was the process? So, you know, I think the series has been listened to and enjoyed in equal measure by skeptics and believers. And for both those camps, I feel like, you know, there is just so much to explore in this.
Yeah. I mean, one of the aspects I've really enjoyed about the way the series has developed as well, Danny, is the fact that you've kind of got this yin and yang relationship with the marvellous Evelyn Hollow and Kieran O'Keefe. And obviously Kieran's someone I've been very well aware of for quite a while due to his well-known reputation as, I know he described himself as an arch skeptic. And despite the fact that if you push me, I will fall on the side of a believer, I've always appreciated Kieran's balance and his honesty when he comes to dealing with subjects like this. So was that an extra aspect, because I know you worked with Kieran before on Haunted on a couple of those episodes as well, Danny, so was it an attempt to kind of have this to-ing and fro-ing, because it's very good to hear both of them come at different aspects of the case from very different standpoints and take very different conclusions from them?
Yeah, well, I mean, Kieran was somebody I've known for a long time. I did a show with him called The Bullshit Detective on BBC Three, like a long time ago now. Yes. And that was the first time we met. But I think he's just, you know, he's somebody who's just, you know, he's great value. You know, like when he takes part in these programs, he brings so many interesting insights to it. And, you know, like certainly with Haunted, there were moments where his skeptic theories for what happened were just brilliant. They were kind of, you know, Holmesian almost, you know, you like really wonderful kind of, you know, ingenious insights into it. So I've always really enjoyed working with him and enjoyed his approach to it. And, you know, he is a skeptic, but he's a skeptic who loves ghost stories. And I think that's why, you know, even people who are staunch believers kind of like him and, you know, react well to him, because, you know, he enjoys the thrill of it. He's somebody who appreciates a good ghost story and isn't part of that kind of skeptic camp who just want to pour cold water and debunk, you know. And, I mean, there is certainly a sort of a group within skeptics who get almost angry about the idea of people believing. I'm sometimes surprised by the level of kind of crossness that I encounter. Like, why the hell would you believe? Why are you bothering? Why are you wasting your time with this?
Yes.
You know, and I just don't get that, because I sort of feel like, you know, don't believe in ghosts if you don't want to, but, you know, surely you can appreciate the enjoyment of the ghost, of the telling of the ghost story, and also, you know, and also be appreciative and respectful of the fact that for some people these beliefs are really important, you know, and ghosts bring comfort to a lot of people. But but yeah, and then in sort of in terms of the mix with Evelyn, I mean, Evelyn was somebody that I came across while sort of, you know, I was really keen. I definitely wanted to include a female voice in it, you know, and I didn't want the series to feel like it was lots of men sitting around pontificating. So that was important to me. And you know, she just felt like a really fresh and new voice, and really, you know, is a great character. And, you know, has this interesting viewpoint of, you know, being a believer and somebody with a family background of, you know, interesting experiences. She calls her mum a spirit talker, and, you know, she's had a lot of experiences herself. And I know that she was, I mean, she spoke to me about being a little bit nervous about talking about that and airing that, and sort of saying, would it make people take her less seriously as a scientist and as a, you know, as an academic? And I felt like it's the opposite in a way, because that those experiences give you this credibility. You know, you have something that Kieran and I don't, that you've had firsthand experiences of these things that, you know, not to the same degree, but, you know, that you've experienced the kind of things that Shirley's talking about. Mm. And it gives you an insight that we don't have, you know. So I think, you know, you see amongst the audience people connecting with different people, and we've had quite a lot of fun with that thing of hashtag team believer, team skeptic.
Yes,
you know, and you know, and it's been fun seeing people connect with a certain person. You sort of, you know, who's your hero, who are you getting behind, Kieran or Evelyn? And but what's been lovely, and I think it has maybe surprised a lot of us involved in it and a lot of the audience, is just how respectful and supportive the dialogue has been, because we do live in these times where we sort of define ourselves by not just what we are, but what we're not. You know, it's very binary, very, you know, we dig our trenches on social media and we're for and against, we love, we hate, you know, and, you know, you can clearly see how the idea of skepticism versus belief could provoke real anger and real strong feelings. And, you know, people say, you're wrong. And we've had none of that. It's been amazing. Like, it's just been this really respectful, nice conversation. This community has built up around it with people with totally different viewpoints and different opinions, but all listening to each other. And clearly, you know, Kieran and Evelyn and the way they have conducted themselves in the show is a big part of that. You know, this hasn't been like that kind of thing that you hear on, you know, the Today program or on Five Live or whatever, where you set up the anti-person against the pro-person and have them argue. You know, we just, you know, we haven't gone down that route. And you know, at the end of the show, at the end of the series, it was really interesting hearing their two different theories, which were really, you know, like poles apart. But, you know, I, and for me, that was a really important way to end the series. I didn't want to sort of be saying half our audience are wrong, you know, and sort of denigrating people who believe or denigrating people who are skeptics. I sort of felt like it's really important for, you know, it's like a sort of choose your own adventure. You know, these are the things we think could have happened. These are the things that Kieran thinks could explain what happened. These are the things that Evelyn thinks could explain what happened. And, you know, here's my theory as well. But the most important theory is the one inside your head. You know, you have spent, you've gone on this journey with us. You've spent 8 episodes listening to this. You know, you've got your own theories. And you know, that's, if there's one thing that is the best thing about this whole experience for me, it's the fact that I've been having all these emails from people who've been spending the last 8 weeks loving doing this detective work, you know, and I've been told that there's a corner of Battersea Library set aside for this case because so many people have been calling them up and asking for maps and documents. And, you know, I love that, you know, that there's this kind of, you know, desire to be supernatural sleuths out there. I think that, you know, that's, you know, that's just been really lovely.
Yeah. And I think one of the aspects that I've also enjoyed about this is your journey as well, Danny, as the host, and our guide to Shirley and the case itself, because it's been very interesting to hear how your perceptions have changed and how you've dealt with the information that you've been given. Because when you look at this case, it is clearly one of the most remarkable alleged poltergeist hauntings in the history of Britain. By no shadow of a doubt, primarily because of the longevity of the case is a key aspect, because most poltergeist cases are a year to 2 years, and then they start quickly, end up keeping everybody awake for the best part of 2 years, and then abruptly stop. And yet this seems to have just trundled along. I mean, obviously, looking at the case, there's a key sort of period from sort of 1956 to about 1963 where Donald, or whatever this presence was, because one of the things we all know about poltergeists is that they're not the most truthful of spirits, Danny, of course. I found that really, really surprising, because, like I say, my experience and most of the cases I've read about, most of the cases I've looked into, are nowhere near this long. So is it one of those that you just couldn't believe how long this had gone on, and you kept being faced with things that challenged your perception of what you thought was going on?
Yeah, I mean, I think the length of the case is really interesting and poses a lot of questions. And, you know, there's clearly a very intense early period where there's a lot of phenomena. It's incredibly rich in phenomena in those really just the first few months, you know, kind of, you know, January to kind of March, April, you know, it's so, so dense with phenomena, and things are happening so thick and fast. And, you know, I mean, the length of the time, I mean, it's incredible. It's one of the things that argues against the hoax theory, I guess, that you do think, like, how and why on earth would a family put themselves through this for that length of time? But, you know, the flip side of that, though, I think, is that you do see, you know, there are many things later in the case where you can make a case for it being things that are perpetuated, embellished, even caused by humans, you know, members of the family. And I think, you know, it gets murkier and more confusing in that later period. And, you know, there is perhaps more ammunition for skeptics in that later period. You know, there's much more robust phenomena, I think, in the earlier period of, like, you know, things that feel really, really inexplicable, very, very, very hard to explain. And it's so hard to say. I mean, you know, as with a lot of these cases, like Enfield, it's this kind of deeply confusing blur where, you know, you feel like there are things that must have been faked by humans and other things that you feel like I can't see any way where it could have been. And it's very hard to sometimes see where those two things meet. And I definitely get a sense. I mean, I use the term supernatural Stockholm syndrome in one of the episodes. This idea that the family were kind of taken over by this abusive presence, you know, literally like a kind of kidnapper who sort of stole their lives away from them. And you get this very strange sense of Donald being like an abusive lodger in the house, demanding things. You know, he has his own room and he, you know, leaves out notes commanding them to do certain things. And, you know, it's so fascinating. Whether you're coming at it from a paranormal angle or a psychological angle, it's so fascinating how the family allowed themselves to be sucked into this kind of life. And, I think one of the things that is most compelling and really does, you know, one of the strongest arguments for this being, you know, actually a genuine haunting, a paranormal case, is this strong sense of character. Like, you know, all of Donald's communications and just, you know, his presence throughout feels like there's a really consistent character running through this that feels very, very, you know, different. I mean, you know, if a member of the family is doing this, they're an absolute genius of script writing and, you know, play acting. And, you know, they've created this character who's utterly convincing and utterly believable. So it's fascinating. I mean, you know, you find yourself when you're talking about the case, you instantly slip into talking about he and him with Donald and, you know, talking about Donald as if he's literally a person in that house. And then you catch yourself and feel like you have to sort of, you know, assess that. And I sort of found myself, you know, you try and add in words like, you know, allegedly and, you know, supposedly and so on. But actually, you're just so caught up in this. You know, you're totally buying the fact that Donald is this presence in the house, that, you know, absolutely causing chaos, this malevolent, you know, spirit of misrule in the house.
Yes. And it's like you say, those early few months are crazy, really, because there's so much going on. And I'm one of those people, like I say, when I hear the solutions or the explanations on each episode, often I will nod my head sometimes and I will shake it vigorously as well when I hear the things. I mean, one of the things that struck me is, as with any of these cases, Danny, you will often have solutions put forward. Hammer toe was one of the things that really made me chuckle, because I can appreciate that being responsible perhaps for some of them, some of the tapping and things like that. But once again, we're talking about something that was making so much noise, it was waking up the neighbours and people could hear him outside. See, I've done it again, I've said him. but they could hear these noises outside. Now, I can accept that, as with any kind of case, sometimes there is a perception of wanting to perform, especially when you've got the media there or people coming round to visit and being the centre of attention. It would be very exciting for someone, no doubt about it, Danny, especially in that post-war era, as you say. And yet, for every explanation, there is another event. And that was one of the other good aspects of Kieran and Evelyn's kind of discussions, that Kieran would put a solution forward for some of the aspects, but then Evelyn would say, yes, well, that might explain that bit, but it doesn't explain this bit. And that was the good thing, because I think for everything you can dismiss in a rational, balanced manner, there would be other situations where you would think, I just can't explain it. Like the milk bottle that floats through the house is a prime example, and has to sort of take turns to get where it needed to get to and plops there. And this wasn't a big house either. And regardless of any kind of aspect of people pointing the finger at Shirley or one of the other members of the household being responsible for some of the incidents, it was a very small property. These people were basically living on top of each other, weren't they?
Yeah, they were, and in very close proximity to their neighbours as well. You know, I kind of like to think of it as a bit of a locked room mystery, you know, that you've got this group of people stuck in this very claustrophobic environment and the impossible happens. And, you know, and I think that's why it is satisfying for both skeptics and believers, that,
yes,
you know, it is trying to crack, how did this happen? How did people witness the impossible? What was the source of that? But certainly, I mean, you know, the noises early on, I mean, you've got this, you know, this street that has lived through the Blitz. You know, the Blitz, the bombing of London was sort of, you know, what was that like, sort of 14 years beforehand, and these people have all lived through it. They've got the, you know, the ruins of the bombed out buildings still on the street, and yet they describe this noise as being like living through the Blitz again. So you get a very powerful sense of just how intense it was. And you know, when we discovered our new witness in one of our case updates towards the end of the series, you know, she spoke really compellingly about, you know, her memories of that time and the noises. But yeah, I mean, you know, so people do have these theories, and you know, that Hammertoe theory that you mentioned, that idea that Shirley was creating noises with the clicking of her toe, you know, clearly had this really interesting parallel back to the Fox sister story.
Yes.
And, you know, the way that they outed themselves as having supposedly created the noises, the spirit rappings with their toe. So, you know, that was interesting. And you kind of think to what degree, you know, was was the newspaper's theory that Shirley was making noises with her toe, was that a product of having read the stories of the Fox sisters, or, you know, had Shirley read the stories of the Fox sisters? You know, is there an idea that, you know, a skeptic view of it could be that she, you know, had heard these stories and then got the idea for doing that? I mean, but clearly, I think the problem with, you know, it was the Daily Mail that did the expose on, you know, saying that Shirley had done everything with her toe. And I mean, clearly the problem with that is, you know, they were using that as a coverall explanation. I mean, you know, you could certainly make the case that sitting in a room, hearing the clicking of a toe, people could be misled to think that that was some sort of ghostly knocking. I mean, you know, that's believable. You know, but the idea that her toe was creating these deafening noises that woke the street, or making objects appear to fly through a room, or make fire start, you know, that's obviously ridiculous. So I think, you know, the journalists sort of undermined themselves instantly by claiming that that was the answer to everything. But you know, I don't know. I mean, there have been various theories put forward over the years, both skeptic and paranormal. You know, there's clearly that theory that Harold Chibbett latches onto in the latter stages of the series. You know, I mean, I was going to say latter stages of the case, but actually it sort of dominated years and years and years of the case. But,
yes,
you know, believing that Donald was the spirit of this historical personality. And, you know, I think none of these explanations adequately explains everything. You know, there hasn't been a theory put forward that can explain everything. The case retains its mystery, which I think is crucial to its longevity. I mean, I think, you know, the fact that we're still talking about Borley Rectory or Enfield or the Black Monk of Pontefract or any of these cases is because they are robust. You know, they do defy our attempts to explain them. I mean, they remain, you know, enigmatic and mystery filled. And, you know, that's why we love them, because we can talk endlessly. We can have these kind of conversations about them. And in a glorious post-COVID future, we can sit in a pub and, you know, chat until closing time about this and never quite crack it. And, you know, I feel like that's important. And it felt to me like absolutely with the series, we were going on this journey and trying to solve the mystery. And at the end of it, we offered potential solutions. But, you know, I was very clear that at the end of it, I, you know, whilst we'd offer these solutions and people will have their own solutions, and, you know, it's brilliant to have done that detective work and to have got to this point. You know, for me, it is a ghost story, and the ghost at the heart of it is, you know, some people will believe that it's the ghost of a dead person. Some people will believe that it's the product of human minds, but it's a ghost that keeps its mystery and defies you know, easy attempts to explain it. You know, and I think, you know, for me, the whole journey was as much about, you know, I keep getting asked that question, do ghosts exist?
Yeah.
And I feel like the much more interesting question is, you know, why do they exist, and what are they? And, you know, clearly they exist because people experience them. And you know, I'm much more interested in interrogating what they are and why we need them, and why they play this vital role in our society. And, you know, for me, this journey wasn't just about telling one family story. It was about those bigger questions and exploring those questions.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's one of those aspects as well that every time you think you might be going down the right path in regards to what could be causing this, or a collection of different things, one of the things that struck me, Danny, about this particular case is Donald's predictions, especially the incident with Jeremy Spencer, which is a very peculiar aspect to this case, that Donald goes through a phase of pretending that he can predict bad things that go on. When you were coming across things like that, did these things kind of take you aback every time you thought, well, maybe it can be explained away, and then you would come across an aspect of the case that just baffles you? Because Donald seemed to go through a phase, like I say, for a few months about predicting accidents for people for some reason.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting and odd part of the case there, and you know, it clearly has a sort of sinister feel to it. You know, yes. This idea of predicting the an accident happening to a celebrity, and then an accident does happen to them. But I do feel like you can never underestimate the power of coincidence. And there are so many moments where he makes predictions that don't happen as well. You know, he predicts that a plane will fall on the house, I think.
Yes.
And, you know, there are lots of moments like that. So we notice the one that does happen.
Yes.
And clearly there are lots that don't. So it's so hard to say, isn't it? I don't know. I mean, it is fascinating. That's one you could sort of feel like you could discuss for a very long time and not quite get to the bottom of. I mean, the you know, what we can say is it's deeply odd and unsettling. And you know, I know that the audience found that one of the sort of creepiest and oddest moments. And it certainly swung the balance from a lot of people leaning skeptically to kind of suddenly believing again. Mm. But, you know, I mean, clearly, you know, you cannot rule out and you cannot underestimate the sheer coincidence. It's one of those things, you know, he'd been making predictions of an accident since September, I think, yes. of that year. And, you know, the accident happens in November, you know, and I don't know. It's odd and yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know. I mean, Jeremy Spencer, the actor it happened to, is still alive, I believe. And I don't know if he's listened to the series or, you know, knows about it at all. But I wonder how he feels about yes. all that. Because I think, you know, my understanding of it at the time is that, you know, that he and I think maybe his brother had contacted the family and found some of the messages from Donald a bit unsettling and didn't like it and kind of wanted to sort of put an end to the communication. So you get this real sense of Donald as the stalker, Donald as the yes. kind of obsessive, pathological stalker, and this focus on celebrities, which again plunges us into this really interesting territory of, you know, it's this era when youth icons and you know, pop culture kind of really explodes. And Jeremy Spencer is shooting a film with Marilyn Monroe at the time of the accident. And, you know, it's, you know, it's such a slice of 50s, you know, that sudden sort of growth of, you know, youth culture. And Donald slots into that. You know, he feels, you know, he is a ghost of his times. You know, he's this kind of fascination with pop culture that feels kind of weirdly contemporary. He's this weird mixture of supposedly, if you believe Chip's theories, being this kind of historical personage contacted them, but at the same time, you know, behaving like a 50s teenager. it's really interesting. And, you know, I think hopefully in our final episode, I'm going to talk to a psychotherapist as well about sort of exploring some of the ideas that come out of that. You know, the idea of Donald being a product of some of the kind of, you know, the collective sort of consciousness of the time, the kind of the traumas of the Second World War and the, you know, then the kind of, you know, fascinations with teen culture. I think, you know, that's really, really rich, I think, that whole area.
Yeah, very much so. And I think one of the aspects of that whole period as well is, you know, as you can say, Shirley is this impressionable young woman of 15. And as you touched on at the beginning, Danny, she does look like a woman out of time, because she's, you know, very vivacious in the pictures. She's very bright and bubbly and smiley, and she looks very fashionable, and her hair's very different. She's clearly embracing that period of time, and her parents are very sort of rooted, you know, 1 foot probably in the decade previously. So there's a lot of kind of social change going on at this period as well. And as you touch on there, the scars of the Second World War are still very raw for a lot of people at that time. So it is an interesting kind of bridge between the old and the new, I think, as well. And Donald seems to be stuck in two camps, as you refer to, that he pretends to be, you know, from 200-300 years hence, and yet has this modern affliction of being starstruck for some reason.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, Kieran talked about Donald being this kind of bridge for Shirley between childhood and... I mean, he actually says between childhood and motherhood, because it's interesting, by the end of the 12-year period of The Haunting, Shirley is a mother herself, you know, and it is this huge chunk of time, you know, this huge period of all of their lives that it goes on for. And, you know, and yes, I mean, he's there at this crucial moment in her life, this shift from childhood to adulthood. And you can see in her descriptions of that time that she had this real childishness. You know, she still played with dolls, even though she was 15 and had just left school. And she kind of wasn't ready to be plunged into the adult world, I think, at that point. And, you know, she was all set to go to art school, and she had this interest in theatre design. And she feels that was all taken away from her and robbed from her by what happened. But, you know, she then goes through this period of being very isolated and very secluded for several years. You know, poor old Shirley, she kind of didn't really have friends during that period. It became a very claustrophobic life, kind of cooped up, stuck between, you know, the press outside and the you know, the fear within the house. And, you know, she's got these two female role models in her life were both housebound, you know, yes. Kitty because of her chronic arthritis and Ethel, the grandmother, you know, because of strokes and was unwell. And, it's a very, very intense claustrophobic atmosphere in the house, and I think must have been quite hard. And so, you know, there's an argument you can make that the latter half of the case, the kind of vision of who Donald is and the letters and so on, it is a kind of, you know, either conscious or unconscious kind of sort of romantic fantasy, if you like, that is sort of fed by both Shirley and Chip. Yeah. You know, I think in a way I sort of feel that's a sort of slightly simplistic argument, you know, that I feel it's kind of much more complex than that. And you know, that there are so many things that when you interrogate it, you kind of think, how could Shirley have known that? There's things in the letters that seem, it's impossible that a 15-year-old girl could have known, and so many things that seem deeply odd and deeply strange. But clearly this is happening at a point where she's moving from childhood to adulthood and isn't quite ready for it, you know, and in some way Donald feels like it is a product of that.
Yeah. I have to say, one of the things that surprised me as well, Danny, was the appearance of Graham Morris, the photographer from the Daily Mirror, who famously turned up at Enfield and got hit in the face with some Lego.
A great story.
And what surprised me about that was I'd seen an interview with Graham a few years ago where he basically poo-pooed Enfield entirely and said it was all nonsense. Didn't think anything of it at that point. Now, we can only go on how that interview may have been cut, whatever, Danny. And it was very refreshing to hear Graham just straight up be very honest about the Enfield case in a way that I'd never heard him speak before. How did you find that? Because, like I say, my experience of Graham was he was very kind of standoffish about Enfield, and yet, on the Battersea Poltergeist, he seemed to be the most honest I've ever heard him when he's been asked about that particular incident.
Well, I mean, that's interesting. I mean, you know, I mean, he struck me as a very no-nonsense, kind of down-to-earth, straightforward guy. And, you know, he I don't know, I found it very powerful. You know, it was one of the interviews that stuck with me most, really, just that thing of saying, I can't explain this, you know. And, you know, and he doesn't believe in ghosts. You know, he thinks that it will be explainable in some way through science in years to come. But, you know, he just said, you know, look, this happened to me. And you know, I was hit by this thing. I looked around the room. There's no way anyone could have thrown it. I'm convinced of that. And it's hard to argue with, isn't it? You know, like, this is the thing about all of these testimonies, that it's really hard to argue with. And unless you believe the person is lying, and again, I'm quite happy for people to sort of throw accusations of being too naive or credulous at me. But, you know, with both Graham and Shirley, I'm pretty convinced they're not lying. And so then you are in this fantastical territory of trying to explain how it happened. And, you know, that's what excites me, really. But well, I don't know. I mean, you know, I hadn't heard him poo-pooing the case myself in the past. I'd heard him on that Radio 4 show, The Reunion, where they got together a small group of people who'd played a part in the Enfield case, Morris Grosser's son and Ros Morris, the other journalist we interviewed as well, You know, and you know, I was very intrigued hearing him on that, and so I wanted to talk to him more. But I don't know. I mean, you know, possibly, you know, the nature of our show was a kind of much more sort of informal show. You know, we're talking to him over Zoom, you know, from his living room or whatever, and it's kind of a longer interview. It's not sort of trying to cram it down and cram it into a sort of 5 minutes on radio and tie him down to kind of some sort of big headline statement about, you know, do ghosts exist or not. But
yes,
I don't know, so maybe that sort of breeds him sort of feeling more comfortable talking about it. But you know, I mean, certainly for me that was one of the highlights of the series, just incredibly compelling testimony.
Yeah, very much so. And it was nice to hear him, because like I say, Enfield's one of those cases, as Roz touches on, that I think a lot of people make a lot more out of these days than actually happened. But once again, it's one of those cases where often people will point to certain incidents and say, well, that's how that happened. But Enfield is a prime example of one of the key starting points is the police seeing a chair slide across the floor in a kitchen. And nobody mentions that part of it, Danny. It's one of those things. And this case has a lot of those incidents where things happen that you can't sort of give a rational explanation for. Certainly not like for the likes of you or I, sir. And we're often left scratching our heads about certain aspects of these cases that just defy explanation, I think.
Yeah, and I think, you know, those witness testimonies, it's kind of hard when you're making a series like this. It, you know, if you say, and a policeman said that they saw this thing happen, it's not that powerful. You know, it's like sort of people will kind of go, oh, did they really? You know, when did they do that? And, you know, maybe they were mistaken. But it's when you hear the person themselves say it that's really powerful. I mean, you know, any ghost story is only as good as its teller. You know, it's about their ability to convey, you know, to convey to us the fear they felt in the moment. You know, the fear we feel listening to a ghost story is you know, is their fear. You know, we're living it vicariously through them. And
yes,
you know, so when you hear the policewoman talking about her experiences at the Enfield case, or, you know, we used little snippets in the Battersea Poltergeist of hearing the lollipop lady talking about having seen Janet Hodgson floating, and I think there's a local like butcher delivery guy, as another, who's again seen things. And you know, those are incredibly powerful when you hear them. You know, they're incredibly powerful as first-hand testimony. When you sort of relay things, it's not as powerful. So like, we have moments with Battersea Poltergeist where, you know, we talked, you know, sort of towards the end of the series, we produced a few other interesting witness statements. So there was a friend of the Shirley's brother, John, who had stayed at the house and had experiences there when Shirley wasn't present. And there were two people, one of them an insurance investigator, who reported hearing noises in their own houses when they went home, you know. And, you know, those clearly are potentially amazing moments that hint at something very, very interesting that doesn't necessarily revolve around Shirley having to be present. You know, but they're not as compelling as hearing Shirley talk about it, because they are, you know, a bloke we don't know and can't talk to, you know, thought this thing a long time ago, you know. And so that's why you need those first-hand testimonies. And that's why, you know, Graham's testimony was so powerful. It's why it's so amazing hearing from Roz Morris. And, you know, and you know, that's why the impact of Pam, Shirley's neighbour, who appeared towards the end of our series, was so powerful. And even though Pam was 5 in 1956 when it happened, you know, I mean, you know, she was 17 by the time the case finished, obviously, you know, so she did definitely, you know, experience things at a time when she was capable of processing it and remembering it. But it's just, you know, it's just so powerful to hear from a real person, you know. And that's what these cases need, you know, to really bring them to life. You know, we people say to me, like, would you make something about Borley Rectory? And I'm saying, well, no, I wouldn't, because I feel like, you know, to do this kind of treatment to another story, you need to have that credible witness at the heart of it.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's what gives it a real level of credence that we don't normally get in situations like this, Danny, is essentially everything is revolving around Shirley.
Yeah, and you know, so it does ultimately boil down to, do you believe her or not, you know? And I mean, clearly, you know, we haven't just launched into making this 8-part series just on the word of one person, you know. There is, you know, we've got Chibs files, we've got the family's diaries, we've got the newspaper reports, you know, and some of the newspaper reports contain, you know, like police and fire brigade reports within them, and there's all sorts of different things to kind of cross-reference and to build a picture of the whole. So I think, if it had all boiled down to just Shirley's word for it, then I think we'd have left ourselves very open to criticism, essentially, of just signing up and being too credulous, I guess, of just, believing one person's word. So I think it's important that, we've given a sense to listeners right throughout the journey of where the different viewpoints are coming from and, where the reference material is coming from. That's what's been great, really. It's pretty unique and pretty unusual to have so much material on the case and to have this incredible resource of all of Chip's files, this kind of meticulously, painstakingly kind of brilliant investigation.
I think I would imagine, Danny, probably the hardest thing is deciding what to leave out, because there are some aspects of this case that are just so weird. One of my favourite bits is Donald's Christmas lists and things like that, because these are such strange aspects to it, like the year he goes mad because he wants a cat, he's obsessed with a cat, and when he can't have a cat he wants a lizard, and then 3 days later he seems to have just completely forgotten about having a cat, and he buys the family Christmas presents and he gets upset if people try to see what he's bought them. There are so many facets to this case that just astound me, and I would suspect that was probably one of the hardest aspects to decide what not to include then, Danny.
I mean, it really was. I mean, I spent a long time working on this, it's the product of kind of a couple of years of research and thinking and sort of 1 year really of kind of quite intense work on it. I've been working on this full time, certainly since, last summer. It's a lot of work, and a lot of that work has been just working out, what the story is and how to tell a story from, 12 years worth of very diverse and often deeply odd events, we had to leave a lot out, and we've chosen to focus primarily on the early part of the case.
Mm.
And, Shirley is still kind of fascinated by that idea of the Dauphin story and the kind of the possible truth behind Donald's identity. And, I'm sure she feels like there's a sort of second series and just exploring that. You have to make decisions about sort of what's going to make the most compelling dramatic narrative and what you feel like the listeners are going to connect with most. And, I feel like, that kind of really inexplicable phenomena of the early part of the case particularly fascinated me.
Mm.
And I mean, I think, we've got this bonus episode, episode 9, where we'll go into some more detail on some of the later aspects of the case, because I know a lot of people have been asking me more about that and about how and why it finished and how it came to an end. And, if people read the book that Shirley wrote with James, I mean, you do get a real sense of just the incredible length of the case and the breadth of the phenomena. And, there are moments like in 1958, Wally, Shirley's dad, writes in his diary about the piano playing itself.
Yes.
And, that's a moment I would have loved to have included. That's such a eerie moment, and there are all these moments that are still, even as the family get used to this and kind of it becomes their new normal, and then they don't have that kind of day-to-day terror that they have early on. It's kind of, they learn to live with it. But even then, right throughout these kind of year after year after year, you have these horrible moments, these kind of violent, disturbing moments peppered throughout. And you see this family who are kind of going through a trauma. They're going through a collective trauma. And that's what Shirley's been processing ever since, really.
Yeah. I think the big aspect for me as well, Danny, is what's going to happen to Harold's work here? Because I find it incredible that no one ever took his manuscript up. I just find it baffling when we look at this case that nobody thought it worthy of print.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that, it's something that he sort of touted around for quite a while, sort of trying to get it printed. I mean, I don't know. I mean, my understanding, I mean, I haven't read through the entire thing. I've read sort of portions of it, but my understanding is that it sort of focuses very much on his attempts to prove the identity of Donald as being, the French prince. And I think, that felt like a bridge too far for a lot of publishers. I think maybe if it had been sort of more of a kind of, a sort of study of his investigation of the earlier parts of the case, it might have, sort of found more of a market, in the sort of,
yes,
amongst the kind of readership of Harry Price books. But I don't know. I mean, you know, Shirley is interested in sort of trying to do something with the manuscript and then trying to get it published. And, you know, a few people have expressed an interest in sort of trying to help with that. You know, clearly there's this huge renewed interest in the case. You know, and I don't know. I mean, I think it's something, you know, like Shirley has read through quite a bit of it, but there are sections that are in Chip's handwriting and quite hard to read. And so, you know, just the job of kind of putting it together would be quite a big job and sort of trying to make sense of it. But, you know, it's interesting. I mean, you know, Chib, at the very least, has left us this incredible legacy of all his files on the case, and you know, this incredible record. And we hope that, you know, if he is somewhere looking down on us, we hope that he's kind of pleased with yes. the way his story has been told in this series. And I don't think you necessarily need to publish that manuscript to kind of bring his investigation back to life. You know, there are other ways you can do that, and perhaps that manuscript is a sort of, you know, a research tool, you know, a kind of, you know, an aspect in terms of telling the story.
Absolutely. Well, it's been wonderful to listen to the show every week, as I'm rather glad you didn't do the piano bit, because we tend to listen to it in bed, so that may have given us too many scares on a late night, Danny, for me and my partner to deal with. I think
I've had a lot of people accusing me of scaring them at night and you know, making them sleep with the lights on. But well, the creepiest story I was told was a bloke who drove in his car to the exact spot he believed of where 63 Wycliffe Road would have been, you know.
Ooh.
Because the house was knocked down, demolished and disappeared. And he drove to that spot, listened to an episode, and then called out, "Donald, Donald, Donald." And tempting fate, rather, but didn't get a reply, thankfully. But you know, everyone's got their own ways of listening to it, whether it's with the lights off or yeah. you know, pulling up outside the house itself. But yeah, that's been nice.
Fabulous. So what's next for you, Danny? What have you got planned? Are you going to carry on with your comedy writing and sitcoms, or has this given you a thirst to delve back into the paranormal going forwards?
Well, I think it's nice to mix between the two. And I think, you know, it's interesting that, you know, you see quite a few people moving from comedy into horror or spookiness, you know, the yes. likes of Alice Lowe and Gareth Tunley, who made The Ghoul. And, you know, and of course, Jordan Peele, you know, who's done it brilliantly with Get Out, you know.
Yes.
I mean, there's definitely, there is, you can see certain parallels between comedy and horror. You're kind of, you're hitting those moments, whether it's laughs or scares. You know, it's quite a sort of technical art form where you're hitting those moments and trying to bring about a reaction in your audience. And also, of course, you know, our instinct after we've been scared is to laugh, you know.
Yes.
So there's kind of, you know, they are bedfellows. But, yeah, I mean, I'm sure I'll keep writing some comedy and I think hopefully we're going to do another series of The Cold Swedish Winter. And, and you know, and then, yes, I think, you know, we're going to do some sort of, you know, another investigation along the lines of Battersea Poltergeist, I think, hopefully, sort of later this year. So, yeah, that will, I mean, my challenge now, I guess, is to sort of sit down and have a look for some new, you know, another case that might be as interesting and rich to look into, which will not be easy, because, you know, these kind of cases don't come along very often, as you know, and clearly this one has been such an amazing story, you know, the kind of the case that keeps on giving, you know. So I think, you know, we're going to try and do another investigation, and it, you know, it probably, you know, it might be quite different. It won't be, I think there's a danger of repetitions. It
yes.
you know, it won't be just sort of, you know, here's another poltergeist case and, you know, let's look into that again. But you know, we're kind of looking around trying to find the right story, really.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I look forward to whatever you've got in store for us, Danny. And congratulations on a wonderful piece of work from top to bottom. And where can everybody listen to the show and follow your work?
Yeah, sure. So, well, the Battersea Poltergeist is a BBC Sounds podcast, so you can certainly look there, or it's also on, you know, all the other podcast apps, Apple and Spotify and everything. And there are 8 episodes out and some case updates in between episodes. And then our episode 9 will arrive in about 2 or 3 weeks as we talk now. So kind of sort of late March, I guess that will be. And then Haunted, my earlier show, yeah, is on, you know, again, on sort of pretty much all podcast apps, and that's an individual ghost story in each in each episode. So yeah, I mean, if you're somebody who enjoys a good ghost story, then please go and explore those two.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for your time. It's been a real pleasure to finally speak to you properly about your work, and congratulations once again on a wonderful, wonderful ghost story, and for bringing it back to our attention.
Thank you, Paul. And actually, it's worth saying just before I go, sorry, like, if people listen and enjoy it, I would love to hear from them, because we've got this email we've been giving out at the end of episodes, batterseapoltergeist@bbc.co.uk. Mm. And I'm still fascinated to hear people's questions and theories. And, you know, I feel like this is a case that will run and run and run. You know, this is not the end of the journey. And I'm still interested in hearing people's takes on the case. So if people listen to this and then find themselves going and listening to the series, you know, please get in touch. And also, if you've got a story, if you've had experiences that have happened to you, you know, I've been very privileged that a lot of people during the course of this have chosen to send me their own experiences and telling me about things that have happened to them.
Hmm.
It's so informative and so kind of, you know, powerful to hear those stories. And I feel really, you know, blessed that we've created this kind of safe space where people feel that they can talk about that. So,
yeah.
So you know, if you're listening to this and you go off and listen to either Haunted or Battersea Poltergeist, and you know, just get in touch and tell me what you think and share your stories, because I love that. And that's, you know, a big part of why I do this.
Fantastic. Well, thank you once again. It's been a real pleasure. And thank you so much for your time today, Danny.
Thank you, Paul.